Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and coming up on a program tomorrow, speaking of mental illness, a follow-up Friday segment on something that came up briefly earlier in the week about Jared Loughner. What's the relationship in some people between marijuana and schizophrenia? As I say, this came up briefly with one of our guests. We will take a closer look tomorrow here on The Brian Lehrer Show. Right now, Vanity Fair contributing editor Seth Mnookin out with a new book this week called The Panic Virus. In it, he examines claims about the link between childhood vaccines and autism in what some say may be the biggest health scare hoax of all time. Those claims were based on the publication of a small study in the late 90s, which concluded there was a relationship between certain vaccines and autism. Now, last week, the British Medical Journal called that study, quote, an elaborate fraud. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Did you rethink your child's vaccinations as a result of the theories that were circulating about the link between childhood vaccines and autism? If you're the parent of an autistic child, have you rethought the origin of that disease in your family? Not that the origin necessarily matters once you're in that situation, but give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post a comment on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Seth Mnookin, welcome to our studio.
Thank you very much.
Can you start by giving us some background on how this claim came to be, that there was a link between the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, or MMR, and autism?
Well, that, as you said, started in the late 90s, 1998, with the publication of a paper in The Lancet on 12 children. And the lead researcher, Andrew Wakefield, said that he had identified a possible connection between the MMR vaccine and gut disorders, and then gut disorders and autism. In the paper itself, he made very clear, and the editors made very clear, that this was entirely speculative. Then in his subsequent public comments, he went much further and, in fact, said that he thought parents should not give the MMR vaccine to their children, which immediately sparked a drop in rates, especially in the UK.
The British Medical Journal, as I said, concluded last week that flaws in the study were not honest mistakes, but elaborate fraud. What about the study was so fraudulent? And do you, after writing your book, The Panic Virus, about this topic, agree with the medical journal's conclusion?
One of the interesting things about that is I think that there's the impression that up until the BMJ report that the study might have had some validity. And in fact, for over a decade, we have known that those results were not valid for whatever reason. And there have been dozens of other studies indicating that there is no connection between the MMR vaccine and autism. The accusations of fraud involve what the BMJ uncovered in regards to what Wakefield reported and what some of these parents said. But I really do on some level think that that's not as important as knowing that the fundamental underlying principle is wrong.
But with respect to the fraud, I gather that there was what at least the British Medical Journal has concluded, intentional misreporting of the timeline,
right,
in some of these cases, right? If the symptoms of autism supposedly set in shortly after the vaccine,
right,
they discovered by looking at the raw material that some of these kids had exhibited symptoms before their vaccine. Some of these kids didn't exhibit symptoms until many months later.
Right.
But somehow they got reported in the original study as shortly after the vaccine.
Right. The original study made it seem as if within these 12 children, there was a very clear pattern. Children are fine, get vaccine, develop autism. And one point that's probably worth pointing out about that is children get vaccinated when they're young, and autism usually first manifests itself when they're young. So I think there are some misapprehensions about correlation and causation. And even if the children had all developed in the way that Wakefield initially said, that would really only be a starting point for more studies. You couldn't make any conclusions just from 12 children.
Frank in Bedford-Stuyvesant, you're on WNYC. Hello, Frank. Frank, are you there? We'll try to get back to Frank. Clay in Englewood, you're on WNYC. Clay?
Yes, hi. I'm the uncle of a 20-year-old autistic child and the father of a 5-year-old autistic, so I have a lot of experience in dealing with the grieving process of the loss of that one suffers when a child is diagnosed with such a condition. Mm-hmm. And I understand the need to have something to blame and the reason why people latch onto things like this flawed study. But more recently, I mean, this can be put to rest for a number of reasons, but I believe it was at the Mind Institute out in Cal Davis where there was a study done where they're able to now identify children as young as 6 months and sometimes even younger. So this, you know, the whole idea of vaccination being related to this is specious at best. And, you know, I know there's a lot of controversy in the families of autistic children about this, but, you know, you have to go past the need for blame and really look at the science.
Have you come up with any theories about the science behind your own child's and your own nephew's autism, or do you just throw up your hands and say, I can't know and it doesn't matter?
Well, when it comes to giving your child the things that they need to get better, it doesn't matter. When it comes to understanding what this is, I've been told is that there's a very strong genetic link to genetic vulnerability to this. And I don't doubt for myself that there is some environmental factor that may very well be contributing to people who have a genetic weakness that might tend to, with the correct insult, express itself in this way.
Right.
But I mean, I haven't seen any research that demonstrates that. But
Clay, thank you. Yeah. I really appreciate you calling in and, you know, opening up about this with a son and a nephew. And so, Seth Mnookin, I mean, we know that autism in children is up.
Right.
Which I'm sure is part of the reason that this theory took off.
Because absolutely.
Parents of children with autism are desperate for answers, not just someone to blame, but a way to understand. And when you look at something, you know, you say something must be different since the rates of diagnosis are so much higher.
Right.
Are there leading alternative theories?
Well, there are a number of different theories, and the caller's discussion of that study is just one of them. There definitely is a real increase. One of the things that has been discussed a lot is how much of that increase is the result of changing diagnostic criteria. We know pretty confidently that whatever that percent is, there also is a real increase. I think one of the undiscussed or something that's not very discussed very often, tragedies of the vaccine controversy, is that we've now spent a decade replicating studies again and again and again because of this fixation on vaccines. And so researchers and federal funding has not gone towards looking into other environmental conditions, which are possibly things that interact with a genetic vulnerability.
Nicole in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, thanks for having me. I slowed down my son's immunizations and separated the MMR as the autism scare was happening. And I was less concerned about autism than I was about how many vaccinations babies get in the first 18 to 2 years, you know, 2 years of their lives. There are minimal toxins in them, but when you build them up all together like that, it could be overbearing in addition to all the diseases. My question is, has this scare made us stop talking about autism, but talk about what are in these vaccinations, why they get so many, who made up the schedule, and why can't we slow it down as parents if we want to?
It's a great question, and I'll tell you that we did that with our kids, not believing the autism theory,
mm-hmm.
but still feeling like it was just so much vaccine load
right.
at once for very tiny children, and our pediatrician let us slow it down to some degree.
Right.
Right. My son received a chickenpox vaccination, and 2 weeks later had head-to-toe rash and 105 fever. Mm. And I was reading a book by Dr. Sears called The Vaccine Book, and it was a very balanced book, I thought. And it sure enough said, 2 weeks after the vaccination, it's possible that your child can get this. And that was very scary.
Seth, did you go that far in the book?
I did. And in fact, I talked to Bob Sears, and I cannot say strongly enough that I think people should not use that book as a guideline. He has no personal experience. He's not a vaccinologist. He has no expertise in this. He bases his recommendations on his own practice. And in fact, one of his patients caught measles on a trip to Switzerland, came back to California, and caused an outbreak that ultimately resulted in $10 million of costs to contain and the hospitalization of another infant. So I think Bob Sears has done a disservice by acting as if he is speaking for the pediatric community. And the AAP agrees with that. The issue of spacing them out and whether the schedule has been something that's been examined, yes, the schedule has been examined. And really, I think an analogy here is you wouldn't start wearing a seatbelt after you'd been driving for a certain amount of time. The goal is to offer protection as young as possible. Today, we, because of how much more we know about the immune system, there actually is a lower vaccine load than there was 15 and 20 years ago because there are so many fewer parts of the virus in each vaccine. I think another misapprehension is that there are dozens and dozens of vaccines on the schedule now. There are 15, which I know probably to some people sounds like a lot, but there are not dozens. And in fact, over the last several years, kids around the country have been dying of vaccine-preventable diseases.
Now, before you go, a couple of things. And my guest is Seth Mnookin, who's written the book, The Panic Virus, about the false link between – apparently false link between and now – fraudulent link, says the British Medical Journal, between autism and vaccines. The media angle.
Yes.
Here's a clip of Jenny McCarthy on the Oprah Winfrey Show.
When I did get the diagnosis, though, boom, first thing I did, Google. I put in autism, and I started my
research. God for Google.
I'm telling you.
Thank God for Google.
The University of Google is where I got my degree from.
And she was a proponent of this vaccines theory, Jenny McCarthy.
A very strong one. For people interested in learning at the University of Google, I would recommend putting in headaches and brain tumors. When you put in things that are scare, that people are very worried about, that's what comes up. A lot of links that indicate that that could be true. So I would not recommend that people go to the University of Google. I would recommend that they listen to pediatricians and scientists who have spent decades and decades looking into this.
Or the University of Oprah.
I definitely would not go to the University of Oprah. I think she obviously has done a lot for charity. I think her health coverage leaves something to be desired.
And beyond Oprah, just the casual, relatively unscientific spreading of things in the media obviously continues to, you know, make myths of all kinds flourish. By the way, coming up at noon on the Leonard Lopate Show, Dr. Paul Offit, chief of infectious diseases at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, will be talking about his new book, Deadly Choices, on the subject of the lack of a link between childhood immunizations and autism. Do you and Dr. Offit agree on the science of this issue?
Yes, we do. He's a brilliant man. One of the reasons I wanted to write the book is because he also is probably the number one boogeyman for the anti-vaccine community. He's developed a vaccine, the rotavirus vaccine. So there are always accusations that he's a profiteer. When I started working on this book 2.5 years ago, I knew nothing about the subject. I had no dog in the hunt. And so what I hoped was I could write something that parents could look at and people could look at and say, okay, he's not a doctor. He doesn't work for a drug company. He doesn't have a child directly affected with autism. So, you know, essentially I'm not Jenny McCarthy and I'm not Paul Offit could trust what I'm writing and my conclusions, because most people can't spend 2 years looking into this.
Vanity Fair contributing editor Seth Mnookin, his new book, The Panic Virus. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, a call-in for college students and 20-somethings on the twin questions. How are you preparing around this phrase that we always hear in the media, that you're the first generation likely to not live as well as your parents do? Is that affecting your major, your career choices, what you do in the first year out of college? And also this new report showing where people in their 20s would most like to live. We'll get your take on that and tell you the results. You can start calling us now, 212-433-WNYC. Do you buy this about being the first generation that won't live as well as your parents? And where would you like to do that living? 212-433-WNYC. If you're in college or in your 20s, 212-433-9692.